No more pronouns, no more climate change obsession, no more emergency vaccine mandates, no more dudes in dresses. We're done with that shit.
It helps when you know that borders are not racist, speech is not violence, America is good, terrorists are bad, men can never become women, police are not criminals, and criminals are not victims.
Cheaper energy, cleaner, cheaper, and we're going to save the world from climate change. And all three of those statements are just patently false.
On the one hand, our plan, backed by the experts of the CSIRO and our energy operators and regulators. Our plan, which stays the course with an appropriate mix of more renewable energy, backed by storage, backed by gas peaking and firming, backed by household batteries, transmission, and a stable system. And the good news is that this is not a trade-off. The same plan, our plan, is the right plan that delivers the cheapest, most reliable form of energy and reduces emissions in this, the critical decade for our planet.
We're going to hand down a much poorer country, a weaker country, a more divided country to our kids. So that's why I'm in this race. I think we've got to smash the consensus there on this ridiculous net zero idea. It was never going to work. Now it's clear it's not working, and that most other countries around the world are moving away from it.
Welcome to the Baseload Podcast. My name is Ben Beattie. For new listeners, I'm an electrical engineer with a career spent in the gas and power industries. Here on the Baseload Podcast, we use facts and logic to prosecute the argument that a baseload-dominated system provides the lowest possible cost electricity to consumers. The cheapest is coal, then nuclear. A high renewable system is far more expensive than both, regardless of the relative cost of the individual units. Yes, it's been a while between shows, but I'm back, and let's get into it. This episode, the GOAT returns to tackle a recent ABC Radio Melbourne panel discussing energy policy, and I interview Andrew Murdoch, director of RK Energy, who developed the report used by Coal Australia in their GenCost submission. I used the show introduction to highlight the positive US pro-energy and pro-human agenda using examples of powerful people getting the basics right. Pete Hegseth, Secretary of Defence. Chris Wright, Secretary of Energy, and of course, Donald Trump himself. Then, unfortunately, we have Chris Bowen, and a small piece of his opening remarks during a pre-election debate with Ted O'Brien, followed by the ever-sane Matt Canavan speaking to Sky News prior to his attempt to gain the leadership of the Nationals Party. Just like the old Sesame Street rhyme, one of these kids is not like the other. That's right, Australia has returned Anthony Albanese as Prime Minister, reinstated Chris Bowen as Energy Minister, pushing the same old insanity. As the dust settles on the election and the Liberals' loss, it's worth considering the Libs' electoral challenges. My typically oversimplified assessment goes like this. Do the Libs go more teal or more Trump? With Susan Lee as Libs' leader and Ted O'Brien deputy, David Littleproud as the Nats leader and Kevin Hogan his deputy, the only inkling we have from the Libs so far is that everything is on the table, including nuclear and net zero policies.
No policies have been adopted or walked away from at this time.
Will the Libs under Susan Lee surrender to the teal model, or will she adopt a more populist Trump approach? The Nats, of course, win the votes in the regional areas where the early impact of net zero policies, transmission lines and industrial renewable sites, are being forced on them by politicians with voter support almost exclusively in the cities. There's a map of Australia on the Guardian website with colours for each federal electorate. No surprise that the entire country is blue except for a few tiny red dots in the cities. So not only do the farmers have to grow the crops, herd the cattle, and cough up the natural resources that keep this country afloat, they are now being forced to host wind, solar, and transmission projects that have a parasitic effect on our economy. This is the transition, and those voting for it don't have to look at it, or live under it, or drive past it every day. Direction for the Libs and Nats is not yet clear, but if anybody out there is listening, here are what I see as the primary problems for our energy systems. Subsidies and targets. The only way to achieve the lowest cost, fit-for-purpose energy system is through a level playing field. We haven't had a level playing field for nearly two decades, and it was the Liberal Party that has introduced the renewable energy target and the safeguard mechanism. The Green-led Labor Party has expanded and utilised these to the great detriment of our country. Rooftop solar. It's the largest technical and economic challenge in the electricity grid, and nobody is tackling it. Rooftop solar kills market share for all generators, renewables too. It introduces uncontrollable volatility into the market every time a cloud passes over a city. It elevates voltages in the distribution network, causing reverse flows and other technical issues. And it creates a new problem, minimum demand, that threatens cascading failures, also known as widespread blackouts. Hello, Spain. There's not much good about rooftop solar. Gas is supposed to be the great savior for electricity system, but it's effectively banned in the southern states, with the greatest demand, and the only other place to get it, Queensland, for the East Coast anyway, would rather export it all. Now, these ridiculous games have been played long enough already, but we have another federal election cycle to watch our critical energy systems and markets unravel even further, making it that much harder and longer to turn around. The political challenge for the Liberal Party and the Nats and whoever is opposing net zero is that too many people in the electorate believe it, think that it's a real thing, and that it's not just a fantasy equation pulled out of the butt of someone in the United Nations a few years ago. It's a crazy concept. Take note that no government in the world has a pathway to net zero. Do they describe what it is? Has anyone ever outlined exactly what net zero is to anybody else? No. The Morrison government tried, and with Angus Taylor at the helm as well. He and Morrison released a net zero pathway. And what did it rely on? Well, if you read it, some of it, like I did, it relied on hydrogen. Hydrogen was going to replace fuel, diesel. It was going to replace coking coal in steel. It's going to be shipping fuel. It's going to provide ammonia to make fertilizer. That's most of the job done, right? All we have to do then is become vegans and grow more crops and buy Chinese batteries and wind farms. Net zero is not a thing. It cannot happen. So the equation in my mind changes then. Eventually, the electorate, the voters, enough of them will wake up and realize that net zero is not a thing. It can't be a thing. At what point, what do the voters do then if all the major parties are still sending the country broke, sinking us like the Titanic, trying to chase net zero? This is the equation that I think these political parties need to consider. At some point, say whether it's 5 years, 10 years, 20 years, whatever it is, enough people are going to wake up and say, we were lied to. All these people, and you can tick them all off, over the years have lied and said, yes, net zero is fine, without ever explaining it. Well, what's the saying going around? FAFO? That's what's happening. And that will happen. It has to, because you can't hide the fact that net zero doesn't work.
Climate action is an essential element of, not a brake on, economic growth, investment and jobs. Our policy release last week, Powering Australia, was accompanied by the most substantial modelling ever released by an Australian opposition on any policy ever.
You and the Prime Minister relied on modelling by Reputex before the last election to promise a $275 drop in power prices by 2025 and a further cut by 2030. Have you now dumped that modelling?
Well, we're fighting the 2025 election, not the 2022 election, and not the 2028 election. We're fighting this election with policies for this election.
Yes, of course, they've dumped the modelling through Reputex under the bus. And do they have any other modelling? No other modelling, because everyone knows it's going to cost more. How much more? Well, no one knows exactly how much more because people have stopped asking. Ted O'Brien tried before the election. Peter Dutton tried before the election. Did the media try? Not very hard. They just let it go. And here we are, another 3 years of net zero policies going to send us down the gurgler. How do I describe net zero policies? I describe net zero policies as like the old trampoline in the backyard. You don't really want it, but you can't really get rid of it. Well, one day you might just get rid of that old trampoline. If you look on Gumtree and try and find one for sale, they're all for sale, but no one buys them. No one wants them. So that's what it is. It's the old trampoline in the backyard that nobody wants. Net zero. In the coming months, I recommend listeners keep an eye out for these milestones. Matt Keane's Climate Change Authority will provide emissions reduction recommendations to the government.
Apparently, these are delayed because of Trump, and they wanted to see what he would do. But we'll see if what they say to the government reflects reality. AEMO's Integrated System Plan 2026 draft will be out soon for consultation, and it will have to acknowledge reality at some stage, you know, on transmission delays and cost blowouts, the end of hydrogen, slow EV take-up, slow home battery take-up, coal plant retirements. You know, it should have all that built into it, you would think. And we'll see what that consultation is and how it differs from previous ISPs. And then, of course, the Australian Energy Regulator's default market offer, the DMO, the final report, will show increased electricity prices. None of these milestones will be favourable to government policy. I wonder which media outlets and even which politicians will take advantage of the somewhat negative outcomes of these milestones. What I want, what everybody should want, is low-cost grid electricity and lots of it. If you want emissions reduction, then you want low-cost grid electricity, if only to get homes and businesses off gas. If you want energy security, then you want low-cost grid electricity. Energy security is a direct result of self-sufficiency. Incidentally, that same argument applies for other sectors such as food, timber, chemicals, liquid fuels like petrol and diesel. Industries that have all the resources a short train or truck ride away should be very cheap. Our electricity system and markets should be boring, stable, and predictable. We are making it all volatile and unpredictable. Volatility brings risk, and risk brings costs. Boring, stable, predictable coal and nuclear power stations reduce volatility, reduce risk, and reduce cost. What would a Chris Wright character do as a federal energy minister in Australia? I believe he'd do these things. He would end the safeguard mechanism, end the new vehicle efficiency scheme, which is actually a carbon tax on vehicles, accelerate the end of the renewable energy target, end the capacity investment scheme, defund the CEFC and ARENA, halt all new transmission projects, halt Snowy 2 construction, end all other subsidies and grants to any project that doesn't stack up on its own merits. In the future, if somebody makes and wins the argument for a carbon tax, so be it. But that argument has never been won in Australia. In 2010, Julia Gillard was elected after saying she'd never have a carbon tax, then she implemented one anyway.
There will be no carbon tax under the government I lead.
Tony Abbott was elected in 2013, saying he'd repeal the carbon tax, and did so.
We will oppose it in opposition. We will rescind it in government.
Chris Wright again.
The United States is blessed with the abundance of coal, oil, and natural gas, and the Trump administration is committed to using them to provide affordable, reliable, and secure energy for the American people.
Imagine if Australia, with the similar resources, maybe not so much for oil, but I'm sure we could find some if we had to, imagine if we had an energy minister or a bureaucracy or a media championing Australia the way Chris Wright champions America. What does Chris Bowen say?
Our plan, backed by the experts of the CSIRO and our energy operators and regulators.
We will invest DOE's resources in sources and technologies that support affordable, reliable, and secure energy and provide a return on investment for the American taxpayers.
More renewable energy.
Since January, the department has approved applications for projects that will export more than 9.5 billion cubic feet of LNG per day, adding nearly as much incremental capacity as the world's leading LNG exporting countries.
Household batteries.
We are also taking steps to accelerate innovation in the commercial nuclear development. America must lead the commercialization of affordable and abundant nuclear energy.
Transmission.
DOE is working to advance the rapid deployment and export of next-generation nuclear technology, including small modular reactors.
And reduces emissions in this, the critical decade for our planet.
As Secretary of Energy, I am honored by the responsibility to help meet the American people's growing energy needs and lead the world in energy development.
If you ever needed an example of the contrast between the energy ministers of two different countries, there you have it. If only we had an energy minister prepared to take on Chris Wright as a role model. You know, I think we might actually get somewhere.
Electricity prices are rising, aren't they, Minister?
I'm not exactly sure what your question is really in reality.
Power prices increase between 2.5 and around 9%. Small businesses are also being hit with price hikes between 4 and 8%.
A fucking goat outside.
It's just a goat.
No, it's a fucking goat.
Okay, to set the scene for this panel, it is hosted by Ali Moore of ABC Radio in Melbourne. The guests on the panel are Dylan McConnell from University of New South Wales, Andrew Richards, the CEO of the Energy Users Association, Tony Wood of the Grattan Institute, Stephanie Bashir of the Smart Energy Council, and Danny Price dialed in from Frontier Economics.
How do we get off fossil fuels and bring prices down?
What a way to kick off the goat segment. It's amazing the sounds you can find on YouTube. As regular listeners will know, I reject the entire premise of that question. This is a pre-election discussion, and it does talk about nuclear. I'm not terribly interested in the LNP's policies from before the election, but what I would like to do is pull apart the arguments against. If you were listening to the episode, you would hear some of it happening in real time, specifically of Danny Price spelling things out and then being completely ignored by the rest of the panel. And as a result of this being pre-election and talking about LNP policies, some of the segments I'm just gonna chop out entirely because they're entirely irrelevant now.
Andrew, I want to start with you with just a big picture question. Why do you think energy has captured our attention in this election to the extent that it has? And do you think that's about the bills people are seeing now, or is it more about worries about the future?
Yeah, thanks, Ali. I think what we're seeing is that energy is central to the economy. Energy is the economy. So higher energy costs impact us in our daily lives, in the things we buy from the supermarket, in the houses we try to build, but also impacts us when we open our energy bills. So it hits consumers in two ways. So if we can't solve that sort of energy crisis that we're in, then the cost of living crisis, which this election is revolving around, is much harder to solve. And
okay, that's off to a reasonable start. Let's continue and see if the goat picks anything up.
I guess part of the problem is, one of the drivers of this, if we are in the middle of a massive transition of our energy system from one fuel source to another.
Uh-oh, here we go. I can feel it coming.
And it's getting quite messy, as we've dubbed it the messy middle of the energy transition, because is coal in, is coal out, is wind in, is wind out. So it's very, not having a level of certainty as to what that glide path looks like makes investment harder, and therefore makes things more expensive.
Perhaps I spoke too soon. I am triggered by the word transition, after all.
The other thing impacting on this is that we have aggressive targets to build renewable energy. And that's really not the question. Is can we build it as quickly as some people want us to?
And there we have it. No criticism of the plan, the targets, how it's all going. It's just maybe we could just get there a bit quicker, a bit cleaner.
And we'll get, let's go to that, because, I mean, all those things that you just mentioned is exactly why we're having this forum, because if you don't get it and you're the expert, then we definitely don't get it. And that is definitely part of the problem. Tony, can I ask you, where are we up to now and can we get to 82%?
Well, Australia has made enormous progress in the last 15 years. 2010, we had about 10% of our electricity was coming from wind and solar. Now it's more than 40%. So 10 to 40 in about 15 years, 10, 15 years. Now, the trick is to go from 40 to 80 in the next 5 years is obviously challenging just on the arithmetic.
Here's a tip, Tony. The challenges are a lot more than just the arithmetic, mate.
And I think it's always very important to have clear targets of what we're going to do and how we're going to get there.
Targets are the problem. The targets are the problem.
But when a political party lumbers themselves with a promise to achieve a certain outcome, such as 82% or a saving off your bill, that's when you don't believe them. Because most of this, a lot of it is outside the control of politicians. So that's where I think the challenge is. Could we get there? It's getting very hard to get to 82% renewable. But if we got to 70%, we should celebrate the progress we've made.
I really struggle to comprehend the logic in celebrating where we are currently in our energy system. It's just unbelievable that anyone would even say that.
Can we do? Do you see that as a more realistic option?
That's where we're heading, right. Honestly.
Okay. Yeah. So, Dylan, can I ask you about the fact that it's not just wind farms that we have to build and more solar panels. It is that 4,500 kilometres of transmission line that I mentioned before.
Allow me to read from the Integrated System Plan 2024 Appendix 5 Network Investments. Close to 10,000 kilometres of transmission is forecast to be needed in total by 2050 under the step change and progressive change scenarios. Skipping forwards in the document, and I quote, "This supports the need for the first 5,000 kilometres of transmission lines to be delivered by 2033, with many of the projects either committed or anticipated and already well underway for delivery." So the number to use is 10,000 kilometres, because the plan is not a 2030 plan, the plan is net zero for 2050, and 2050 needs 10,000 kilometres. That's the plan. That's the only plan.
All of that, I mean, we need batteries for storage. All of that requires the land to build it on, the skills to build it, the technology to do it. With all of that, do you see us moving fast enough?
Is this the question we need to be asking right here at the moment, at this point in time of the panel? Are we moving fast enough? If there's any of these myths or these this framework that needs to be challenged, is that all this policy and planning, this net zero stuff, is a foregone conclusion. It's ridiculous to assume that. How does Dylan McConnell approach this question?
Look, at the moment, there are some promising signs that we are, you know, getting in the investment that is needed to get there, particularly in the last sort of 6 to 12 months. If you look at the financial investment decisions that have been made, there is quite a bit of activity in the large and, you know, large scale renewable energy and also utility scale batteries that would put us within the range of the kind of capacity we need to be installing to get to 82% by 2030.
From where I'm standing, it just appears to be more of the same. 82%. Wahoo. Has anybody mentioned the cost yet or the effect on consumers of chasing these ridiculous arbitrary political targets?
That said, there is a big difference between those financial commitments and actually delivering that. And that's going to be, you know, that's going to be a real challenge, you know, as Tony pointed out. You know.
Why on earth would anybody say that it's challenging for a developer to build wind and solar in Australia? They're subsidised to the hilt. All policy, state and federal, is pushing in the same direction. What's the holdup? What's the problem?
We have done very well. We're at, you know, just over 40%, but getting to 80%, you know, it requires us to build the amount of large-scale renewable energy we've done since the beginning of the NEM.
And that's served us so well, hasn't it? Right?
Almost, you know, two times over in the next 5 years. And that is a very challenging task. But, you know, there are green shoots there that suggest we could be getting close to the right level of activity.
If there's any journalists out there, please chime in with a question related to and the effect on consumers is.
Can any of you take a stab at what it's going to cost?
A lot more than people think it will.
Andrew Richards is the Chief Executive Officer of the Energy Users Association of Australia. According to the Energy Users Association of Australia website, Andrew Richards has over 30 years of energy industry and infrastructure development experience, having held a variety of senior management roles in the areas of sales and marketing, public and stakeholder relations, media and communications, strategic planning, policy development, stakeholder engagement, and political advocacy. No longer reading from the Energy Users Association of Australia website, but reciting from my brain, Andrew Richards sounds like a nice guy. He's also incredibly right in this area. It is going to cost a lot more than people think. Why would that be? Why would people think that a renewables transition is going to save them money? It's going to be less cost to consumers. Who would ever say such a thing?
Electricity prices are rising, aren't they, Minister?
Well, thanks very much for the question, Chris. I'm not exactly sure what your question is really in reality. I think that renewable energy is the cheapest form of energy. It's disingenuous and dishonest of you to blame all this on renewable energy. If we keep the path we're on, energy prices would fall by 13% over the next 10 years.
Am I making the picture clear for everybody at home?
We're just seeing the massive blowout in costs of building the transmission lines as one thing.
Yeah, massive blowouts in transmission costs obviously going to contribute to the regulatory asset base, the RAB. This needs to be made mainstream terminology to the masses. They need to understand this stuff.
I think what we need to understand is that the people who build wind, solar, transmission lines and all the other associated bits for the energy system are very similar to the people building roads and bridges and cross city tunnels.
Well, this is a new insight. I hadn't thought that the people who are building wind and solar would be building 50 to 80 to 100-year infrastructure, which would actually be productive and help people.
So we're in the middle of an infrastructure boom where we clearly, at the moment, don't have the number of skills that we need. We can't get the equipment into the country that we need, some of the specialist electrical equipment.
I find it incredible when people refer to wind and solar generators as infrastructure. Infrastructure, almost the definition of infrastructure, is designed to make us independent of the weather and the climate. Dams, bridges, you know, major freeways, roads, all this kind of stuff is infrastructure. It is structures that enable us to overcome the natural environment. Wind and solar make us dependent on the natural environment. It is not infrastructure. It is a parasitic industry that reduces our energy system's efficiency and productivity, costs us all a lot more money, and as soon as we realize this and wake up to the fact that it is not infrastructure and it costs us a lot of money, we need to dig our way out of this hole. We need to turn the ship around.
So these are challenges, as I think Tony mentioned, that are just outside government's control because we're not the only country trying to do this.
Sorry, Andrew, you're dead wrong on that. Australia is one of the only countries pursuing, through dedicated policy, a net zero economy. This is outrageous that anyone would say that every other country is doing this.
We're actually competing against some very large economies who are looking to do exactly the same thing. So the challenges aren't political per se, they're just physical in nature.
Good grief. Just stop it already, dude.
And I guess, I mean, should we believe anyone when they give us a cost?
If we keep the path we're on, our energy prices would fall by 30% over the next 10 years.
And this might be a good place for Ali Moore to ask the panel, what are Bowen's costs?
We'll look at the nuclear plans for the coalition in a minute, and they're putting a figure on that of $331 billion. But, I mean, it's all numbers, isn't it, to a point, until we actually know exactly what the time frame is.
I think that's been the challenge. I think one of the things we're probably going to all agree on is that this was never going to be cheap and easy, and we were promised that it would be.
Is Tony Woods disagreeing with Chris Bowen? Is he saying, Chris Bowen, you're full of shit? Is this what I'm hearing? No, it couldn't be.
We did model the impact of our policies and released it very transparently. And that modelling showed that renewable energy is the cheapest form of energy. And if you get more in, you will see downward pressure on prices.
This was never going to be cheap and easy, and we were promised that it would be. Now, the trick of that, of course, is we get to the point we are now, and we're now in a messy middle, as Andrew mentioned.
Now we get to Tony Woods qualifying his criticism, qualifying his statements. It's just a messy middle. It's a transition. Everything's going to be okay once we get to the end of it, and we just have to persevere, right? We just got to get through this. One team, guys, one team.
It feels hard. And the temptation is to say, oh, it's all too hard. We should stop.
I just need to pause here and take a breath. Oh, dear. Yes, please, let's stop.
This is not a choice we have to stop. Really important is, do we now take a bit of a fork in the road? Because
and this is where we get the sob story about the climate change and it's a consensus and, you know, we have to do something. Everybody else is doing something. We can't be left behind. You know the story. What I do know is I do not like being peer pressured and bullied into crazy stuff like, yes, Australia can change the climate. We just have to do more. Pull our own weight. Please, debate it. Argue for a carbon tax. If you can't argue for a carbon tax because you know you won't win, maybe that tells you something.
Climate change is no longer debated in terms of its reality. It's upon us in Australia now. So how well we do it dictates how much progress we made, not whether we do it or not.
We're taking a brief break from this performance by Tony to recall a fairly famous Tom Segura segment from several years ago.
You can't say retarded anymore. It was just here, don't you remember? Retarded. It's gone. People get very upset. I don't really support the arguments against it. Like when people are like, you shouldn't say it. And you're like, why? And they're like, what if there's one over there? And you're like, we never said it like that. We were never like, look at that guy. You didn't say it like that. You said it to describe an idea or a situation, you know? Like if your friend was like, I'll pick you up at your house and then we'll come back to my place. And then later we can go back to your house and we can get your bags. And then we'll come back over here after that. And you're like, well, that's retarded. Why the fuck would we do that?
Thanks, Tom. I entirely recommend watching Tom Segura's specials on Netflix. He has a way with words. Let's put it that way.
Stephanie, do you have a thought around cost and the extent to which we can believe what we're being told?
What if there's one over there? And you're like...
You know what? Maybe I should swap the goat for Tom. I don't know. Stephanie Beshear was introduced as someone from Nexa Advisory, her own firm. She's, according to the website, the internet, it's out there. It's a thing. Stephanie Beshear is a former board member of the Smart Energy Council, whose CEO said this on Hansard.
The coalition's energy policy is a bit like a dog, circling around and around, finally coming back to eat its own vomit.
If listeners want to listen to what Stephanie Beshear has to say, you'll have to dial into the actual ABC recording. I'll put a link in the show notes, but I'm not going to reply anything she has to say here beyond this short snippet.
And the key thing is that our coal power stations are aging. So we've got over the next
five to seven years.
I don't think we'll get to 82% by 2030. That doesn't worry me. Mm. What really is important is creating momentum beyond 2030 to make sure we stay on the path, and also not just electricity. All the other parts of industry which produce emissions also have to be on the journey to net zero.
Of course, Tony, because why would you stop at destroying our electricity sector? Why not destroy agriculture, transport, you know, industrial manufacturing? The world's your oyster when net zero is the target. Skipping forwards a bit from some irrelevant fluff, let's get into batteries, home batteries.
And this is his 30% rebate on household battery systems. Dylan, if I can ask you the extent to which you think it's going to make a difference, and what about for all those people who can't afford the other 70%?
Okay, story time. Back in 2016, I was working for QGC. I started working for them in 2012, finished in 2018. But I got sent out there on a fly-in, fly-out roster in 2014, my son was three, my daughter was one. You know, this is all the fun and games that you get up to when you're trying to make the most for your family by earning as much money as you can in as short a time as possible. And there are some sacrifices, to be honest. Something the people who live with their parents till they're 30 might not understand, to be honest. Anyway, sidetrack. I'll talk to Cameron Murray about housing some other time. The fact is that in 2016, I was an operations engineer, QGC, up at Willoughby Creek, and it was a period of quite high electricity prices. Now, QGC, operating a lot of electric-driven compressors, centrifugals, screw compressors, and a few other things around the place, have electricity demand of, I don't know, 300 megawatts, roundabouts, roughly the size of the Gold Coast. Significant, right? And when you have half-hourly price spikes around the $15,000, $16,000 mark, they can incur the equivalent of a monthly electricity bill in a matter of an hour or two. After wages, electricity is their biggest cost. Now, some will say, why didn't they go into a power purchase agreement and have some contract arrangements. Anyway, there's some history there. Other people were involved in those decisions, and it is what it is. So I was hunting around looking for some visualizations of what was going on in the wholesale electricity market, Googling all the rest of it, calling some people, making some phone calls. Anyway, I came across OpenNEM as some research project. Anyway, I called up the university. So I actually sent them an email. There was I can't remember the guy's name. I've got the emails there somewhere in a PST file, as you do from back in the day. And I sent him an email. I said, you know, I'm Ben Beattie. I'm from this gas company. I'm looking for some information on visualizations of electricity because we want to understand what's going on out there. And the guy got back to me and said, oh yeah, we're working on something like that. And here's Dylan. Copied me in, sent me an email. So I said, okay, Dylan. Sent him an email and we started talking. Anyway, Dylan seemed like a nice enough bloke. Talked to him a couple of times. He was great. Somewhere along the line, Dylan has been, I don't know, what do we say? What do we say about when you've had the wool pulled over your eyes, or you're a dedicated believer in stuff? It's there's an ideology out there. Let's just say that. Now I'm not blaming Dylan for this stuff, but I think if he took a step back and looked at what he's saying objectively, then perhaps he'd come to a different position. Anyway, that's end of story time. Back to Dylan.
Look, I think it is a quite a impactful policy because there is a lot of potential learning and public benefit from driving down the costs of distributed solar, distributed storage, I should say. And if you're looking at the projections of what our future system may look like, there is a large amount of this distributed distributed storage. So having a mechanism in place that can drive learning by doing and cost reductions in that space is a useful contribution.
Sorry, mate. The projections you mentioned are not really projections. This is the integrated system plan. There is no other system plan that talks about the batteries, and the batteries in the system plan, the integrated system plan, which is the step change scenario, are driven by demand assumptions, which are largely driven by take up of electrolyzers, take up of home batteries, take up of electric vehicles, and increased electrification. All these things are not projections based on historical facts. These are assumptions required to meet political targets, 82%, right? And it is entirely incorrect, inaccurate to call these things projections.
I think there are legitimate questions to be asked about targeting and who benefits that and how those benefits are
So have a listen to the language here, the words, the choice of words specifically. Words actually have meaning, right? So distribution of benefits, subsidies for batteries, reduce the cost of batteries, take some of the cost of the battery away, leave a whole lot of the cost of the battery there, distribution of benefits. Who does this benefit? Where is the distribution coming from? Who pays for the distribution? I've said the word distribution so often, I feel like I need to add the word re to the front of it. Redistribution. I wonder where that comes from.
That said, batteries do benefit the wider network as well. So it's not just the homeowners that will benefit, though, yeah, there are questions about how renters and low-income households may benefit from the transition as well.
What do you mean? What do you mean? What do you mean?
Julie is in the Melbourne studio.
Rental homes that are too cold in winter, too hot in summer, and too expensive to run because the homes are poorly insulated, drafty, and the appliances inefficient are making people sick. What would you do to reverse this without the costs being passed on to renters?
Stephanie, let me bring you in here.
Retire. That's fine. No, you're not allowed on the podcast. Go away. What does Andrew Richards have to say about renters and their opportunities? Because, you know, the transition's all about opportunities. It's going to make everything better, right?
I think that renewable energy is the cheapest form of energy. It's disingenuous and dishonest of you to blame all this on renewable energy. If we keep the path we're on, energy prices would fall by 30% over the next 10 years.
Is anybody seeing the problem yet? Are you feeling it?
We may end up making the same mistakes we've made with solar. So we've rolled out solar. There's about 5 million homes with solar at the moment. Now, if you've got solar on your roof, you can avoid a lot of the system cost. Those costs don't go away. They just get picked up by people who don't have solar. And that's creating a bit of an inequity issue, and that's where we see renters and others really suffering. So we don't see the targeting that Dylan's talking about. I think that's absolutely crucial. And the question goes to, who are the most vulnerable in society? Who can't normally get access to this? Let's have a really targeted program that's not just about chucking batteries into the system.
So that's something we haven't got. So that's not a policy we can pull apart here today, but it's something we need.
Let's just take a second to appreciate Ali Moore's screeching U-turn. Andrew Richards, CEO of Energy Users Association of Australia, is explaining one of the basic facts that we all know, we all appreciate, which is anybody with solar has been subsidised, hasn't paid a full bill in years, someone else is picking up the tab. That someone else is people who either can't afford the capital expense of rooftop solar on batteries, or they don't own their own house, so they can't entertain the idea, or maybe they're in an apartment building, they don't even have a roof. You know, this is one of the basic facts that we all understand this. And Ali Moore has just said, no, I don't want to talk about that, sorry. Move on.
And we are trying to sort of break down the major parties' energy policies. So we've had a look at renewables.
Have we though, really? Have we really looked at renewables? Or maybe have we just accepted the narrative and what the people are giving to us, feeding up to us as the gullible listener?
Labor's plan also involves gas. We'll come back to gas as well. But let's look at the opposition's nuclear plans.
No, not interested. Not after the election. We've got another 3 years to sort that out. The opposition's nuclear plans, well, as of middle of May, we don't even know what they are yet. So let's just leave that and go back to, we'll cut back into the panel when we're talking more about Labor's plans, which are the actual plans, which is what they're going to try and push on to the system and force us consumers to pay for.
Will be a really significant, dramatic shift in the energy landscape for this country if there is a change of government. So to that end, we've invited Frontier Economics to join us as part of this discussion, as Frontier Economics are the ones who have done the costings for the coalition. Danny Price is the Managing Director of Frontier Economics. Welcome, Danny. I really appreciate you being here.
Thank you.
So the next segment in the Baseload podcast is just a series of questions posed to Danny Price of Frontier Economics by Ali Moore of ABC Radio Melbourne. Now, Ali Moore seems to be very well researched on nuclear policy. She, judging by her questions, she must have read some stuff. So on the face of it, objectively, just on Ali Moore's interrogation of Danny Price, you would have to say that this is good journalism. But when I present this in context of the wider effort that she's making with this panel, you can see the problem. Here we go. Here is the full 2 minutes of questions just from Ali Moore to Danny Price.
Nuclear in the mix is cheaper than no nuclear. Peter Dutton talks about costs being 44% cheaper, but that's not 44% cheaper on my bill, is it? So essentially you're saying that if I open up my bill in 2030, let's call it 2040, because we don't know how long it's going to take, it will be 40% cheaper than it would be if nuclear hadn't been in the mix? So how much cheaper will my bill be? In your modelling, have you included the cost of keeping those ageing, relatively unreliable coal-fired power stations going for much longer? We know CSIRO has really criticised your costings. What do you say to them? Where do you think you've got it right and they haven't? Timing. Very big issue around timing. The plan is for two small modular reactors or two larger ones. The technology is not decided, and they would operate by 2035 or 2037. So essentially that means that if the coalition wins government on May 3, they've got 10 years to change federal law, to convince all the states and territories, to get the social license, to work out where they're going to put them, to do all the testing, to build it, and then to run it. Mm-hmm. It's doable? But it's not on a commercial scale, it's a research reactor. Essentially, this reservation policy will ensure that uncontracted gas from the big producers in Queensland will be kept back for the domestic market when it's required. What will that mean for my energy bill? A reverse tariff, wouldn't it? If you do export and you don't keep it, we're going to lump you with a levy, so you're going to lose the benefit.
Yeah.
And for prices, what's it going to mean? Danny Price, thank you so much for being with us this afternoon. It's really good to hear someone who's actually crunched the numbers. I know our panel has also crunched the numbers.
And now, around about 2 minutes of questions from Ali Moore to her panel. Let's see if you can pick the difference.
Tony, can I ask you, where are we up to now? And can we get to 82%? Not just wind farms that we have to build and more solar panels. It is that 4,500 kilometres of transmission line that I mentioned before. And all of that, I mean, we need batteries for storage. All of that requires the land to build it on, the skills to build it, the technology to do it. With all of that, do you see us moving fast enough? Should we believe anyone when they give us a cost? We'll look at the nuclear plans for the coalition in a minute. Stephanie, do you have a thought around cost and the extent to which we can believe what we're being told? So are people saying, you know, I don't know what to do? What happens if we don't get to 82% by 2030? What turns the lights on? This is 30% rebate on household battery systems. Dylan, if I can ask you the extent to which you think it's going to make a difference, and what about for all those people who can't afford the other 70%? Is there anything on the table, maybe Andrew, I can start with you, anything on the table from any party that does deal with the renter? Labor's plan also involves gas. We'll come back to gas as well. But let's look at the opposition's nuclear plans. Start with the coalition's nuclear policy first. Tony, do you buy it? But by system costs, you're talking there. Alternatives, yes, maybe, but also storage.
Everything.
We just
storage,
need really good storage. Do you buy it? The whole nuclear plan? Whether we can do it or not, and I'm thinking nuclear here, does it boil down to political will? Gas reservation policy, we just heard about that from Danny Price. Andrew, let me ask you whether you think it will work. Stephanie, can I bring you in here? I just want to really ask, is this sort of stuff just a Band-Aid? And for many people, it's the most concrete thing, because that bill right in front of them right now is going to be lowered. But do you think that that maybe should not be at the forefront of people's minds? On the one hand, the politicians are saying, we will give you cheaper prices. And yet that seems disconnected to the very long-term, massively expensive transition that most of us have bought into for net zero by 2050. It's interesting, in the ABC, you'll say there are a number of questions saying, what happened to climate change? No, it just doesn't seem to often be part of the conversation. So the tough question that I want to put to all of you, is there one party or another which is more likely to deliver for more Australians? So you would say Labor is going to help more people when it comes to emissions.
Absolutely.
Is there one party or another you'd like to say will deliver for more Australians? I want to put it to you that, you know, you've got your mum and dad fish and chip shop, and then you've got your major manufacturer. So what are they, you know, where are they going to put their eggs? Tony, what are your thoughts on whether there's one party or another that would help more Australians? Many of the big energy producers are getting on with it one way or another because they don't have a choice.
Despite Ali Moore offering at the top of the show a balanced overview of energy policy from both sides of the coin, what we got was a unified takedown of the coalition's nuclear policy, coupled with a unified support of Labor policy. This is not balanced in any way. I'm going to wrap up the GOAT segment here, but I will insert Danny Price's response to Ali Moore's first question. It's a very good response, and it just wipes all the rest of the debate out of the water. Enjoy.
Yes, when you look at the system-wide costs, once you add up all of the capacity that you need to reliably meet demand, when you put nuclear in the mix, it's dramatically cheaper than just renewables alone. And so people have been talking about the reliability of coal. The ultimate unreliable generator is wind and solar. And so you basically need about 3 to 4 times as much wind and solar capacity for every 1 megawatt of dispatchable generation. And so once you add up the costs of all of the extra wind that you need, plus the battery to store it, plus to back up, it's actually relatively expensive. So logically, it will always be a more expensive option. And so when people talk about renewables being cheaper, they're only really referring to the cost of a wind farm or a solar plant, not the whole total system cost.
Electricity prices are rising, aren't they, Minister?
Well, thanks very much for the question, Chris. I'm not exactly sure what your question is really in reality. I think that renewable energy is the cheapest form of energy. It's disingenuous and dishonest of you to blame all this on renewable energy. If we keep the path we're on, energy prices would fall by 30% over the next 10 years.
Andrew Murdoch, welcome to the Baseload podcast.
Thanks, Ben. Great to be here.
You are you managing director, founder of RK Energy?
Yeah, that's correct. I am the founder and managing director of RK Energy, a small energy advisory based here in Brisbane.
Excellent. Well, you get stuck into the details like few people do. So we're sitting here at mere moments after you've done a presentation to Energy Facts and Fiction, which is Mark Oswald and CRE Insurance, suppliers to the fossil fuel industry, for anybody who's in doubt about what we're talking about today. Your presentation was about 10, some pathways to help reduce electricity prices. And you focus mostly on sort of the wholesale and network components, right? And maybe the regulatory side as well. Is that pretty correct?
Yes, yeah, so I presented a presentation called 10 Policies That Will Reduce the Cost of Power. I've looked at generation, I've looked at transmission, I've looked at distribution, I've looked at monopolies, I've looked at increasing competition and economic efficiency, and I've also looked at some of the options that we have for carbon abatements and how we're paying for that.
Okay. Yeah, so I made some quick notes here. So number one, no bans. Number two, more gas. Number three, less regulation. Number four, you had a discussion about the cost of avoidance and how to make that balance out and be consistent across the different industries. Number five, correct me if I'm wrong, was more like a carbon tax on the economy instead of targeted specific things across the place. And you mentioned different safeguard mechanism baselines depending on the mine and how good their paperwork is, right? We talked about no technology targets at number six. You talked about some consistency across the sector. No subsidies, a level playing field. A level playing field is good to hear someone say that as well. I appreciated that. You went into rooftop PV and we talked about I'll describe that as sorting out the how rooftop PV, the feed-in tariffs work, and that should be related to the regional reference price or the wholesale price in each state. You talked a bit about government ownership and the advantages that GOCs have, and a really good example, I thought, was when you mentioned that would a private company ever get development rights for Kosciuszko National Park like Snowy Hydro did a couple of years ago? I thought that was a really good example. You talked about increasing contestability in networks, and I would paraphrase that as saying more competition in the networks. And then you had a couple others with gold plating and bits and pieces. How did I do? Did I pay attention? Are my notes okay?
Yeah, your notes are pretty good. They're Ben. Obviously, each of those points are fairly complex. So perhaps happy to go into depth into any of those as you wish.
Well, I think no bans is obvious. More gas is obvious. Less regulation is pretty obvious. We'd all be in furious agreement there. Point number four, I thought, was actually interesting, and your avoidance costs. So maybe we can start there. And what's the point you're making to the group?
Yeah, so point number four, and apologies to people who weren't at the presentation. You're just going to have to
we've raced through it,
to keep up with the inconsistent numbering that you're going to get over the audio. So point number four was to make the decarbonisation currency fungible and denominated in dollars per tonne CO2e. So why do I use the terminology currency? Well, currency is a certificate that's written by the government that you use to satisfy some kind of statutory obligation. So historically, the Australian Treasury prints Australian dollars, I earn those Australian dollars, and I use those Australian dollars to satisfy my tax obligations to the government. If I've got any left over, I can use them for trade. And
the government says you can't make your own; you have to use ours.
Correct. Well, actually, getting into banking theory, you can actually generate currency by fractional lending, et cetera, et cetera. But that's a discussion for another another day. So I use the term currency policy to talk about certificates, so LGCs, large-scale renewable generation certificates, STCs, small-scale technology certificates, and ACCUs, and SMC, safeguard mechanism certificates. So I consider all of these a currency. They're issued by the government in exchange for something, and they're used by people operating in the economy to satisfy an obligation to surrender LGCs, STCs, and ACCUs.
And the overriding idea is that this is a mechanism to help reduce emissions.
Yeah, essentially, where it contrasts with dollars, you know, a dollar might be issued by Treasury to use, you know, to be given by the government to perform a service for government. Whereas an LGC is created in exchange for producing a megawatt hour of renewable energy, an STC is provided by is provided for installing a solar panel on someone's roof, and an ACCU is provided in exchange for offsetting carbon emissions.
But they're not that you can't. Can you use a say an LGC to? Can you buy an LGC from a wind farm and then use it to offset a plastics business, for example? Do they come out of the industry and can you use them elsewhere, or do they once you've bought it, it's done?
That's where my recommendation on fungibility comes into it. So you can't use an LGC to satisfy an STC obligation or an ACCU obligation, and vice versa. You can't use an ACCU to satisfy an LGC obligation. So all of these currencies are intended to minimise our net carbon emissions as an economy, but they all have different supply-demand balances and all have different impacts on how they reduce or the cost of reducing CO2 emissions. So if I can give you an example. So an LGC, large-scale generation certificate, if I make a megawatt hour of renewable power somewhere in Australia, I can generate an LGC. Current market price for that is around $19 a megawatt hour.
That's come down quite a bit, hasn't it?
It has come down quite a bit, yes. Now, if I use that megawatt, if I use that LGC to offset other sources of energy on the grid, and let's just use the Queensland grid average of 0.71 tonnes per megawatt hour.
That's the emission intensity this point in time, roughly?
Correct. The cost of that carbon abatement is $19 divided by 0.71, which is $26.76. If I go to South Australia and produce a megawatt hour of renewable energy down there, sell it for $19, same price, but the average grid intensity factor in South Australia is only 0.23 tonnes per megawatt hour, so that results in an abatement cost of $82.61 per tonne of carbon abated. So there's a difference in price and therefore a difference in the economic efficiency of using this same commodity, this same currency, the LGC, to offset emissions or to reduce emissions. It's much more expensive on a dollars per tonne basis in South Australia than it is in Queensland. That factor also changes as well during the day as well. So, you know, if you're making renewable energy in the middle of the day, there's lots of solar. The average grid intensity
solar offsetting solar.
So the average grid intensity is lower. If you're doing it in the middle of the night, the average grid intensity is higher because there's no solar on the grid and everything's backed by coal.
So that's interesting actually, because when you think about in those terms, are they an added cost on the generator or the retailer in the terms of the fungible dollars you talked about, or is it just the LGC price that affects them?
So the LGCs, the obligation to surrender LGCs falls on energy consumers. So my retailer, when I buy my power, my retailer is obligated to surrender approximately 23% of the megawatt hours of energy that I consume in LGCs to the Clean Energy Regulator every year.
This is the 33,000 gigawatt hours part of the RET.
Correct. Yeah, so us energy consumers are paying for it.
Yep. Okay, so it filters down through, but it's really just the LGC price is the one thing. So how does the difference, say the tonnes per megawatt hour, I guess what you're saying is that the LGC price in South Australia is not achieving as much emissions reduction as an LGC dollar, as an LGC is in Queensland or Victoria?
Correct. Exactly. Is that in Queensland, you're likely to be reducing your overall coal burn, whereas in South Australia, you're likely to be reducing your overall gas burn. And so the intensities of the two are different, and therefore the cost in dollars per tonne of CO2 avoided is different.
So you're distilling all that down into like a recommendation. What do you think would be a sane way forwards for a sane Labor government, a Chris Bowen type, if he was going to go, let's rehash the whole system and come up with something that's useful, fit for purpose for the next 20 years or so? What do you reckon would be the go?
Yeah, so I would consolidate all of our certificates into one carbon abatement certificate. Let's call it an ACCU to use consistent terminology. So I would put the I would essentially redesign the system to consolidate down to one certificate, whether it's generated by renewable energy or offsets or some other mechanism.
And that would then drive, because you'd get a higher price for it in, say, Queensland, Victoria, New South Wales, that would drive that investment, that subsidy into those areas rather than into, say, South Australia or even my favourite, Tasmania.
Well, correct. Yeah, you would drive your carbon abatement investment into the sectors and areas that have the most impact. So you mightn't even put it in the power sector at all. You might go and do soil carbon abatement, for example, because that might be cheaper than renewable energy anywhere.
We'll leave the ACCU discussion there for a minute. At the start of your talk today, you mentioned something very interesting to me, which was that without carbon reduction policies, coal power would be cheapest. Now, you've done some work on this recently. Coal Australia engaged you guys to do some groundwork, some detail work on coal-fired power costs. And you're not biased in any way because you do similar work for renewables and batteries and whatever. What did you find with that work?
Yeah, so today's presentation, I made the assumption that a carbon emissions reduction policy is required. That obviously has an impact on cost. Nothing clean is cheap. With the exception of, renewable power is cheap when it's cheap, but it's not cheap when it's not cheap, and that depends upon whether the sun is shining or the wind is blowing. The work we did for Coal Australia was essentially to provide an estimate of the cost of providing new baseload generation onto the grid. Mm-hmm. We took an apolitical view, so RK Energy is an apolitical organisation, and we try to disengage our work from our individual politics. Mm-hmm. So to achieve this, we looked at benchmark prices on a number of projects that had happened around the world. We looked at prices at project costs from...
You're talking about coal projects?
Coal projects, so ultra-supercritical modern coal projects from Vietnam, China, India. These are the places that are building coal-fired power station. We also looked at the last coal-fired power station in Australia, so that was Kogan Creek.
Mm-hmm. 2007-ish.
2007. Established a set of benchmarks. We normalised those benchmarks for Australian conditions and Australian costs, so Australian labour productivity and the cost of managing Australian compliance, mm-hmm. and estimated our own capital costs, our own what we considered to be a reasonable capital cost for the construction of coal-fired power stations in Australia.
Yeah, and I think, correct me if I'm wrong, but I don't have it in front of me. I should have been more prepared. But the number you came out with was it more or less than $2 billion for say a new Kogan Creek? I guess where I'm going for the listeners is that here's a report by a reputable consultancy that says coal power is not that expensive, to be honest.
Yeah, so the reason we did this was essentially, irrespective of what side of politics you are and whether you're pro-coal, pro-renewables or otherwise, the debate is better informed with good information. What I am concerned about is that we are undervaluing or underestimating the costs of providing deep baseload. And by deep baseload, I mean power that can be dispatched on a 24 24/7 basis, most of the time, in a planned manner, can respond to load, and the kind of and at the cost that make things like aluminium smelting achievable.
You think they an aluminium smelter in Australia would jump at sort of $60 to $80 a megawatt hour, 24/7 power, right?
Look, potentially. Look, that's obviously, you know, in my view, a fairly good deal.
In a level playing field, then, and if there was, even with emissions reduction targets, so that's going to inflate the price of coal. Is there room for coal in an emissions constrained market?
Yeah. Well, look, I think one of the points that I wanted to make at this morning's presentation was to choose the decarbonisation options that are most economically efficient. And that might be soil carbon offsets, it might be renewable power, it might also be CCS. So there will always be a linkage between carbon emissions and energy consumption. If you better understand the economics of both power generation and carbon emissions, and you have good data to select projects from, you're more likely to choose the most economically efficient option that you have available to you.
Yeah, and if you could do that without the without some of the ideology, which what I'll call it, around emissions, then carbon capture should be on the table, right? Just like nuclear should be.
Yeah, look, in my personal view, yes. In my personal view and in some of the work we've done indicates that carbon capture and storage on a new ultra-supercritical project could be a competitive way of producing baseload power with very, very low carbon emissions. I also believe nuclear would be able to do that as well. And
Frontier Economics did a report a lot like that, right?
Indeed they did, yeah. So you know, slightly different methodology, but yes, they certainly found that the cost of nuclear would be much less than perhaps others are suggesting. Based on some of the numbers we've done, retrofitting carbon capture and storage onto existing coal-fired power plants would also be economically efficient, particularly those located in the Surat Basin where there's good access to deep saline aquifers.
Yes, because with the CCS, the carbon capture and storage, the storage part has a physical location, and it's not always at the same location as the CC part, right? So then you need to move it and get it in there. So if it's similar to a coal-fired power station being built on top of its own mine, if it could be built on top of its own mine and its own sequestration pit, whatever you call it, geology, then potentially that cost comes down a long way.
Well, yeah. So you've got to look at carbon and capture storage as a reverse gas field development. So you've got to find the right geological structure, and it could be a depleted oil reservoir, it could be a saline aquifer in sandstone, you've got to do the exploration and the seismology. You've got to drill the wells, the injection wells.
Gee, I wonder how we do that. We haven't done that before.
It's very much oil and gas engineering and project development. It's just you're putting gas into the ground rather than taking it out.
Okay. So you've got your report open now, and I guess we've talked about I've boasted a little bit, and you've been more reserved about the cost of coal, etc. What is your sort of headline numbers from your report as far as coal goes? Do you explain it in terms of capital cost to build in terms of dollars per megawatt capacity, and then do you talk about it in how does it make a return in dollars per megawatt hour? Is that where it sits?
Yeah, so let's start with capital cost per megawatt hour and then move on to LCOE. So LCOE is levelized cost of energy. So if I look at the work that we've done where we've taken benchmark prices from overseas, benchmark capital prices from overseas and moderated them to Australian dollars, we get CapEx per megawatt hour in the order of $2.5 million up to around about $4.5 million. So we go from sort of substantially less than what the gene cost estimates were to almost but not quite as expensive as the gene cost estimates.
And are these numbers, so that $2.5 million per megawatt to 4.5 million per megawatt. Their recent overseas projects converted to Australian dollars?
Correct, yeah. So those project timeframes are over the period from 2015 up to 2024. And yeah, so okay. we've obviously escalated those prices to deal with inflation. We've converted them to Aussie dollars and also moderated them to allow for Australian labour productivity and Australian compliance costs.
Okay. And what sort of megawatt capacities are we looking at there? Are we looking at big ones, small ones, medium ones? Because Australia's market, the biggest is 750 Kogan, but then Eraring at 720s are not far from that. And then you get your sort of 680s, 660s, and then you get a few in the sort of 300 to 400 range.
Yeah, so these are similar sized units, so roughly 700 megawatt units, multiple lots of 700 to 1,000 megawatt units. So, Van Fong, for example, is 1,400 megawatts over two units.
So they're not dinky little projects overseas, they're proper man-sized coal-fired power stations.
They're proper power stations. So similar in size to Kogan Creek, for example.
So you take their costs and then you convert them to Australian using a few parameters, and you get something like half to three quarters, or half 50%, maybe 80% of gen cost. And we're not here to criticise gen cost. Plenty of other people have done that. But just to give the listeners a comparison. So if you're going to build a 700 or a 750 or a new Kogan Creek, say in Australia, is that a $2 billion, $2.5 billion project?
So if you were, let's say we took a mid range of say 3 million per megawatt, something like that. Mm-hmm. Multiply that by 750.
You're in the low twos.
Let me just get my calculator out. So 3, 1, 2, 3.
We're engineers here, not proper engineers.
Yeah. So look, $2.25 billion for something of that as an order of magnitude.
And this is something you'd plonk on an existing mine with existing facilities. And the mine, et cetera, would be extra, because GenCost methodology, Oricon's behind GenCost methodology does have some of those other costs built into it.
Yeah, so one of the things we did differently when considering LCOE was that we looked at the cost of coal and where would you put a baseload power station in Australia if you had that opportunity now out of all of the sites. Now, my personal view is that I would put it in a location such as the Surat Basin, where you have low strip ratio coal, you have a reasonably good carbon to hydrogen ratio, and you have a low cost of mining. And this coal is not doesn't have the infrastructure to allow it to be to be exported. So you're decoupling it from the export market. Yep. Low cost of mining. I wouldn't wash it. I would simply crush it and throw it straight into the furnace and let the furnace separate the.
And you design your fuel handling system to manage that. Yep,
correct. Yeah. So.
So you're talking about like say $2.5 billion, round up a little bit. For a new Kogan Creek power station, I did something similar to this in a letter recently to an ABC journalist, and I compared to Lotus Creek Wind Farm. So I said, if you're going to build a 750 megawatt Kogan Creek and it's going to cost you $2.5 billion, you'd actually need around about 7 Lotus Creek Wind Farms, which means the cost is kind of like to get 2,000 megawatts, right? And this is you need 2,000 megawatts of wind to the equivalent of 700 megawatts of coal, and then you need other stuff on top of that. And this is where the cost benefits of the baseload system, the high capacity centralized units, exist, right? They're centralized, they're not dispersed, and they generate a lot of electricity for not much footprint.
Yeah, well, one of the advantages that you have is that, you're producing that 750 megawatts or 1,000 megawatts in the one spot. So it's not generally all of the coal basins already have reasonably good transmission infrastructure into them, because mm-hmm. that's where historically we've built power stations.
It's so kind of plug and play in a sense.
Yeah, look, there will be local. If you go and put another 1,000 megawatts out in the Surat Basin, yes, you are going to have to augment the transmission network a little bit, but it is going to be centralised, and megawatts of dispatchable capacity per kilometre of transmission is probably a pretty good ratio.
Okay. On your other numbers, so we got with the capital cost. What's the other numbers we're talking about here in LCOE?
Yeah, so LCOE comprises essentially the cost of the capital, you know, amortised down over whatever the life of the power station will be. We chose a 50-year life rather than a 30-year life. You've got the fuel cost, which we've already spoken about. You know, we've chosen a mine mouth cheap coal that's not exposed to the export market, as opposed to as opposed to perhaps a coal that is, you know, currently supplying a Stanwell or a Gladstone that has to go to the power station on rail and is essentially export parity, because that train could just keep going to the port and pop it on a ship. So,
and they might pay the fine for not delivering to the power station and sell it for twice as much overseas.
Potentially.
You found an LCOE.
So we found an LCOE, and we used the same, you know, for consistency, we used as many of the assumptions that GenCost used that we felt were appropriate. For example, weighted average cost of capital, we didn't change that. And I think we used the same operating and maintenance cost as well. Yeah. So obviously the biggest contributor to LCOE for most power stations is the capital capital contribution, and because because the real world benchmarks indicate that these are somewhat lower than other estimates, then our LCOE came down as well. So our LCOE ranges, or our LCOE estimate ranges from 54 up to the high 60s, almost $70 a megawatt hour, which compared to current average pool prices is pretty good.
It's a big discount.
It is a reasonable discount. So, one of the critiques of baseload power stations is that they have to incur negative pool prices. No one likes losing money. But if on average over the year, the average pool price is greater than your long run marginal cost of operation, then you can withstand the negative pool prices as long as you're making up the difference in the peaks. And then you've got the opportunity to optimise as you go.
So there you go, $2.5 billion to build a new Cogan Creek in the right place, and $50 something to $60 something a megawatt hour to run it indefinitely. And I guess over time your inflation and bits and pieces would go up, but coal itself doesn't inflate, it doesn't change price, it's just a rock in the ground. Andrew, any last comments?
Oh, look, I think I'd encourage listeners to number one, look beyond what the media says. Go and do your own research. Look at some of the benchmarks that are out there. Go and do the analysis. And I would also encourage, if carbon abatement is what we want to achieve as an economy, let's pivot to economically efficient ways of reducing carbon on a dollars per ton basis, and deploy the most efficient projects on a dollars per ton basis, irrespective of politics, irrespective of whether you like coal or you like wind or you don't like coal or you don't like wind. You know, put our personal biases to aside. Look at the hard engineering and economics, and choose the energy and decarbonisation options that give us the best combination of cost of power to consumers and dollars per ton CO2 abated.
Andrew, you've been a sane and logical guest. Thanks very much for coming on the show.
Thank you, Ben. Appreciate the time.
You've been listening to the Baseload Podcast. If you like the show, subscribe and tell your friends. Remember, the mailbox is open, thebaseloadpodcast@gmail.com.